Welcome again to the Cannabis Investing Podcast, where we speak with C-level executives, scientists, and law and sector experts to provide actionable investment insights and the context with which to understand the burgeoning cannabis industry. I'm your host, Rena Sherbel. Hi again, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Happy Monday. Welcome to a special Monday edition. For those of you following us on Twitter, you already know that we're about to drop this episode, but super happy to bring you my conversation with Ben Kovler, the famous, the known CEO of Green Thumb Industries, one of the top multi-state operators in the U.S., one of the top MSOs in the cannabis U.S. landscape. And you find out why they got to that place today. Ben gives a lot of insight into how they got to the top, or certainly near the top, of the tier one group of MSOs. We released this full video interview on CEO interviews on Seeking Alpha, but this is the full audio interview that I hope all our Cannabis Investing Podcast listeners will enjoy and glean a lot of insight into the U.S. cannabis landscape and why Ben is one of the most often requested guests on this podcast, but also when we're talking about the U.S. cannabis landscape in general. A lot of great nuggets in here. And don't forget Masterclass number 3 coming Wednesday. I'm releasing it as fast as I can because it is so good. Wait for it. I hope you all are enjoying these episodes that I think are very salient and essential part of cannabis investing today. Hope you enjoy it. Hope everybody has a great week. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice of any sort. I am Long Trueleaf, Chiron, Istrakhan Biosciences, the parent company, Air Wellness, and the ETF MSOS. You can subscribe to us on Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. Ben, welcome to Seeking Alpha. It's great to have you on the show. I really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So cannabis is in the news today and almost every day, it seems, in the past couple of years, but certainly in the last, like, let's say since the election, for sure, on fire. Green Thumb at the top of, you know, every real cannabis investor's mouth, I think. One of the top multi-state operators in the States, you know, everybody figures them in their tier in their list of tier one MSOs. Talk to us about what Green Thumb, first of all, does in the industry, how you would describe it.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for saying that. We work hard to make that the case. I like how you said, you know, any serious cannabis investor. You know, what we're doing here, what the thesis is, what we're up to, is a U.S. cannabis operator. We have licenses in various states, I think 13 states as of today. The thesis is this is Prohibition 2.0, and that brands distributed at scale is going to be how to win, and that this is a consumer product, and that the American consumer is going to develop an authentic, real relationship with the cannabis products. And those brands will speak to consumers and drive that spending and drive that growth over the next decade. That today is a $20 billion industry. It was below 10 when we started. That'll grow to 80 to 100 billion in retail dollar volume. That'll lead to a huge amount of taxes, a huge amount of jobs, and market cap valuations that started when we went public below 2 billion that are, I don't even know the number exactly today, that'll go a lot higher.
So talking to us from kind of coming from where you're coming from before you started Green Thumb, you co-founded Green Thumb. You are coming from a family that has a lot of ties in the Chicago world, private equity world, but I was also interested to learn that your family comes from the alcohol business, that they were involved with Jim Beam. I'm curious how much you grew up with kind of hearing about the alcohol business, or did you have any thoughts about that before getting into cannabis? Was that something kind of on your radar in general, that part of the marketplace?
Sure. Yeah, a lot in there. So yes, family business before my time was in the bourbon business, Jim Beam. That means my great grandfather, out of Prohibition the first time, partnered with the Beam family in Kentucky to build the Jim Beam company that was really centered around one brand. And then the family sold the business in the late 60s. It was really my dad who grew up thinking he'd work for the company, loading whiskey trucks and working in various parts of the business. But when he graduated college, heard they sold the business. Why did they sell? If you step back a little bit, it was a time when conglomerates were being built in American capitalism. And tobacco companies thought cigarettes were bad for the public's health, and they were going to diversify. And so Philip Morris bought Miller Beer, and a company called American Tobacco bought Jim Beam. So the family sold. So it really, my grandfather stayed involved. He was the CEO, president, I think, for 10 years or on the board after the sale. Family had owned it and run it for 30 plus years. So we're long-term investors, we're long-term operators, and I sort of invented the thesis around this. I didn't invent the line, but that history rhymes. I think it's a Mark Twain line. But the rhyme of history is real. It's real to me. I can see it and feel it, and it's fun. And in that, this is Prohibition 2.0, and the rhyme is how cannabis will emerge and be part of the American economy the way alcohol was. And there's various kinds of elements to that. So that's where it was. I didn't grow up thinking much about alcohol, but I learned some of the brand characteristics of Jim Beam, which was a almost 100-year-old brand now. And one of those is just for example, is Beam was one of the first companies that had a square bottle and a white label. If you think of the Beam bottle today, it's in the original is square bottle, white label, and that was new. And square bottle, square shake, an honest approach, and the white label being clean. And then an approach around Generation Gap and Sean Connery. So I guess I was aware of that stuff, but the simple ideas around brands, which are really reflected today, hopefully in some of the stuff we do, and really the successful American brands out there, cannabis or not.
And was part of the kind of the draw to cannabis, was that prohibition story? Was that coming to the end of a prohibition story? Was that part of what drew you? Or what was it that led you to start Green Thumb?
Yeah, I mean, the intrigue of what's going on. So the supply-demand setup, the way the licenses worked, the positivity that this product creates. If I had to boil it down to a common denominator, I would say positivity. It's enabling users for well-being. The opioid data is pretty overwhelming. And having studied in school sort of how new markets worked, my major was called PPE, which is philosophy, politics, and economics. This fits right there. So I'm mentally very intrigued by what's happening here. This is stimulating and interesting from a society standpoint, from an American economy standpoint, from an American leadership standpoint. And here we are with a business centered on these products and these brands that's exciting and fun for me. If it wasn't fun, I don't think I'd be doing it. We're having a blast. This is incredibly interesting. I think we can bring a lot of positive change. So that's where it started and really is the same driver today. It's the same thesis. It's a bigger team. There's more at stake. There's more media coverage. There's more eyeballs on it. But it's really the same thing happening.
So talk to us about the initial stages of starting Green Thumb and how you set out to kind of set up Green Thumb. There's, you know, when you got started, there were, there still are many, many players in the industry that don't come from, you know, necessarily a strong financial operation background, you know, and suffered from kind of the pangs of learning how to do that. It seems to me, as somebody that follows the cannabis industry, that Green Thumb has kind of nailed that from the get-go. You're one of a few operators that I think have done that from the outset. Talk to us about your thoughts behind how you wanted to start Green Thumb and your kind of points of emphasis as you started.
Sure. Great question. I mean, this plays for my strengths really well, my history, my skill set, what I have knowledge in and sort of what I would aspire to make and create. So from the beginning, things like the Wall Street Journal cover test, which is an idea I learned from Warren Buffett, which is as simple as every act you do, you should be comfortable with it being on the cover of the journal or your local paper, such that your mother, brother, cousin, neighbor, you feel okay and proud to see that on there. So that's like a moral compass where everybody is their own compliance officer. And certainly we've been tested on that with things in the paper, and we do feel comfortable about what's going on. That's how we make decisions. That's part of our orientation. That's been the story from the beginning about how we've built the business centered on the exact same sort of core theses around brand. It's been a lot of, you know, doing the math on not losing money. Capital allocation, raising the right kind of capital, bringing in the right partners, setting up the right kind of partnership structure, treating people how you'd want to be treated, those sorts of core principles. And it's really just grown from there. It was an exciting time in 2014. You asked about how did I start it. My initial thought was, you know, I don't know if I've told the story a lot or ever, but, you know, I thought I would invest in a few groups. We interviewed tons of companies that perceived themselves to be going to be successful in the Illinois application. This is 2014, you know, January, February, March, April, May of 2014. Saw just about every group that was applying in Illinois to learn about the industry and what was going on, and realized that I would be better off doing it ourselves. Created a group, several of the same folks that are here today, and applied. Really making common sense capital allocation decisions the whole time. Really, really, really simplifying something that is incredibly complex. We thrive in that complexity, I think. We're good at unpacking that stuff. We're good at doing well on a test where we can see the practice test or what have you. And that's why we've done well.
And in terms of growing that, as you moved beyond the kind of initial stages, you know, you can point to a lot of metrics that companies would point to as proof of kind of how you've navigated the financial side of things, but, you know, consistent profitability, you know, really strong revenue growth. I think you guys are set for $500 million revenue. Talk to us a little bit about how, with each step, you kind of maneuvered the changes to becoming bigger and scaling more. For instance, like, it's pretty clear that you started in Illinois because you're from Chicago, but how did you choose to go to different states? What was the thought process or acquisitions that you've made? How did you make those decisions?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, first, I study the numbers a lot. I'm very comfortable with that. You know, we did over $550 million last year. And so the business is on a pretty big run rate, doing, you know, just under $200 million in the first quarter this year. So the size of the business, the profitability, from, you know, a very strong gross margin to SG&A under control, which yields a pretty good EBITDA. And then we've actually hit net income profitability and free cash flow generation. So despite a 280E structure, the business is generating free cash. And the reason that we've done that is really, to your question, is it's capital allocation is the short answer. The two-word answer would be capital allocation. The longer answer would be, what that means is, where you put your chips, right? We raise the money, those are chips to put in a game, in a bet, in a business, and to allocate to people, human capital, intellectual capital, you know, actual hard capital, you know, goods that we've built, facilities, to make something that's gonna yield more than we put in. I mean, it's as simple as you put in 100, how much can you get out? Some people, it appears, go into a business where there's a negative gross margin. They either don't see it, don't want to see it, don't like seeing it, and then they keep spending into that. That's like the worst thing you could do ever. So we don't do that. And if we see it, we stop spending into it. And instead, it's more fun to go somewhere where you can put 100 in and create, you know, 500 in revenue and 100 in profit, or whatever the numbers end up being, if that analogy works. Or think about the casino. I use that a lot. Like, if you're going in to play poker, why would you go to the game where there's a lot of other sharks there that are likely to take your chips? Whereas if you go to a game where you understood all the rules, you knew your cards, you knew what was coming, you knew the other player's cards, and you knew that you had a good hand, it's a lot easier. Why go play in a knife fight when it's easier to go sit at the beach? Like the analogies are all the same. And that is our capital allocation strategy. Put money where one is going to equal three, not where one is going to equal 50 cents. It seems like obviously commonsensical to do that. And the reason we're able to make those decisions is by studying the data. And that has to do with the simple principles of really supply and demand, and also like where things are and what's happening. But that's it. That's why early on we were Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, Nevada. As those markets unfolded, it was not Colorado, Oregon, Washington, or California. And, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio become very obvious. New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Florida, it all just makes tons of sense. And all of a sudden we have a portfolio that looks like, oh my God, this is the portfolio you'd exactly like to have. But that's because of studying the numbers in advance and kind of seeing the cards that are gonna come out. And it's not that fancy, it's not that big of a mystery. Here are the cards that are gonna come out in 2 years. New York's gonna be a massive market. It's not a big mystery. We know that because of how many people live in New York, and now it's legal. So it's just like the most basic principles. And so we knew that before, which is why we have a license there. We didn't apply because the application was around the same time we did Illinois, but we acquired one in 2018.
And as you see it developing, I mean, the legalization picture is, you know, it seems developing every minute. A lot of headlines, a lot being talked about, while maybe not everything is happening as quickly as we would like it to, or as quickly as the headlines would promise. But yet there are a lot of changes happening, and certainly with legalization. I mean, just this week, Amazon came out and, you know, made a big step towards furthering cannabis legalization, saying that they're in favor of it, that they're going to stop testing workers. That was a huge thing for the sector. But within that, within this evolution that we're seeing, how do you think about the evolution? Do you look at the West Coast, for instance, or do you feel like, let's see how the legalization picture plays out, and I'm kind of happy on this Northeast kind of region that you guys have cobbled together? How do you think about it, and how do you plan for this process of evolving legalization?
Yeah, there's a lot of dimensions to that. The evolution of the legalization at the state level, the federal level. There's also the evolution in the capital markets, stocks, which we've been ahead of. There's also the evolution of the product, which has to do with who the consumer is and the education level there. And I mean, what I would say is we're just watching them all incredibly carefully in order to sort of try to be in the right place at the right time. But the mystery on the legalization is, guess what? It's sweeping the country and the velocity is increasing. There's no mystery here. In the last 4 months, I think you've had New York, New Jersey, and New Mexico all legalize. That's on the back of a green wave sweep in early November that included, you know, other states like Mississippi or the Dakotas or Montana. You know, the world is changing. The common sense approach to this product, led, you know, with people that are now used to be anti, that now understand that a medical cannabis product helps people. Some people have a negative reaction to the idea that cannabis is an exit drug away from opioids prescribed by your doctor that actually kill you. So like those, that's a fact, right? Doctors prescribe opioids that kill people. Cannabis will take people out of that predicament. Not everybody, it's not an elixir, but the data shows us that less people die, literally, if there's a marijuana store nearby. So to us, that data is hardcore fact. And really, we believe in it, and that fuels our bets and our conviction. The second piece is the tax generation from the product. So a legalization regime in a state run well should generate hundreds of millions of dollars of tax revenue. Simple example, whether it's Colorado, Nevada, and now Illinois, where it's been legal for a little over 15, 18 months, we're on a run rate of $400 million, $350 million a year. That's going to grow into the state. And you look at state budgets and how to solve some of these state issues around revenue without raising taxes on the citizens or real estate taxes or other things. That momentum is very real. We've seen it in other industries like gaming or other things where state governments get very, very into new revenue streams. And last, we just see like massive consumer demand. People don't like to be hungover. I mean, I haven't met anybody that likes to be hungover. People don't generally make good decisions on alcohol. There's a whole wave against that. How about sleep? Who in America would say like they want a better night's sleep? Most people.
Right.
It's amazing. And we can hit these like common sense use cases with the American consumer, and we tap into huge demand. So like all of those waves combining make this, you know, too big to stop. When it happens, when the capital markets open up, when the anomalies and inefficiencies and listings and capital access and cost of capital open up, you know, we'll be ready. But it doesn't matter so much as long as the consumer is buying the product and states are opening up. So we put the business, we think, in the exact right spot.
So do you spend time thinking about like the exact parameters of which states go online, or when interstate commerce is going to open within the developing picture? Or do you feel like as you mentioned, you kind of go from point to point and take it more like, have the big picture kind of solved for and then take it more as it comes.
I mean, we're top down and bottom. We know every single state. We know every regime. We know what's happening in each state. We're analyzing interstate. We're waiting for Schumer. We're listening to our peers in the industry talk about it. And we're watching what's happening and using all that to make decisions effectively.
And then, as you mentioned, the other factors that come along with the developing legal picture, like uplisting, you guys have already benefited from some debt financing from institutional investors, which some other companies have too, but not very many. But like that institutional capital that comes in with legalization, that uplisting, that maybe full legalization needs to happen first, maybe it doesn't. How do you see that playing out, or how do you think about that?
Well, we think a lot about cost of capital. Yeah. And you've seen this year we've raised equity capital. You know, we raised $156 million in the $33-$35 US range. And then we raised $217 million of debt at 7% with some warrants back in that same range. So we think about it a lot. We've studied other industries, and we think those with the lowest cost of capital, access to capital, are those that win. And so that's exactly how we win. The simple way I talked about it with the team in, say, 2019, so April 2019, April or May, market was peaking, Canada was legalizing, and there was a lot of froth. We raised debt, and I liken it to we took an umbrella when it was sunny, and that's literally what we did, and we raised $105 million, and first time anybody, I think, in cannabis at the time had raised that kind of debt. It cost 12%, and we invested that money into the business, all of it. And that's like what you're seeing now in the business. And we continue to scale that. So we think, as opportunistically about the capital markets as we can. We think we're winning at that game. And that's really about developing great partnerships and loyalty with investors by doing what you say you're going to do and, not overpromising. And that's been good momentum for us. We're not waiting for a major change. It will be great when we can list. It's ridiculous that American cannabis companies can't list on an American exchange and American investors can't buy the company making American joints. It's oxymoronic, but that's okay. It's kind of slow motion inefficiency. It doesn't hurt us as a business. It means you need patient investors, but it doesn't make any sense. There's no reason that American investors should be funding Canadian operations that aren't profitable. That's like silly. But often common sense and logic aren't as forefront on the decision tree for others as they are for us. So in the meantime, we put ourselves in a position. We're registered with the SEC. They approved our S-1. We raised primary capital. That was the first time ever. And we're ready to list. It's up to the exchanges and their lawyers, when they would like us to list. They have their own concerns. But we've done everything to put ourselves in the right position. We've driven down our cost of capital. We think we have a cheaper cost of capital than the Canadian LPs because we think we have the best business model going, even with 280E and other things, on the simple basis that there's a huge amount of demand and we have the supply. And so that's the business. So we're focused on it, but we built Green Thumb on the conditions today, understanding where they're going to be tomorrow to take advantage of today. We don't need something to happen later to make it work. We don't need the growth. We don't need the listing. We don't need the X, Y, or Z, the law change. We're positioned for it. Example, New York.
Yeah. So, speaking of how the sector needs patient investors, to kind of wade through these inconsistencies, these oxymoronic, regulations that we have, certainly something that's happened in the past year, I think with the Democrats winning the White House, there was this huge blue wave and also a number of states going online. I think, huge excitement in the sector and a lot of share prices exploded. And then that kind of petered back out. And there's been a lot of volatility since in terms of volume and share prices. How do you see that playing out? Do you think it's like uplisting, bam, it's consistent, it makes sense? Because the valuations for a long time didn't make sense based on how the companies look. But now that the companies have kind of caught up, curious where the value, where it falls in line. How do you think about that?
So here's how I think about that. I think that Ben Graham said it best, that in the short term, stocks are a short term voting machine. And in the medium and long term, it's a weighing machine, right? Ben Graham's professor, he was Warren Buffett's professor. So that's what's happening, is it's voted in popularity and then it's out of popularity. These markets are thin. The capital market depth is not deep. And so in the short term, it's subject to the sways. Last 4 or 5 months, here's what we did. The equity prices went up. There was more interest. We raised capital to go invest on behalf of shareholders. It's a home run. If your duration is a week or a month, wrong game. You're in like a different thing. We're building a business that's going to have value over the medium and long term. And we're trying to attract shareholders that are aligned with management and that objective, right? The board, the strategy of what we're going to do. So I'm not focused on the day-to-day. I mean, I'm aware of the market and what's happening, but it's not a big focus for me. We are focused on the cost of capital and bringing in the right capital at the right time. So the business has over $350 million of cash on the balance sheet to go invest on behalf of shareholders, and we should do a pretty good job. Back to the first thing, we should go to the table where we can turn our smaller chips into much, much bigger chips. The game could take a year or three, and we want to be with people that are going to see that through with us. And we're really fortunate. We feel very lucky. And we've been a first mover, pioneer, effectively bringing in new capital. And we're aligned with our shareholders. They're aligned with management and the strategy. So I'm not worried about the short-term voting of what's happening in the day-to-day. It just doesn't affect us. It's not about our business. Those people that are trading stocks, maybe cannabis is a good place to trade, maybe not. I think it's way better to invest in U.S. cannabis operators, Green Thumb and others, and see in 3 to 5 years. Way better. But everybody can do whatever they want.
Everybody can do whatever they want, but I'm going to agree with you. I think investing is the place to be for cannabis as well. I'm also curious, you know, in terms of management style and how you're leading. One of the things I think that makes a lot of sense in these current times is for management to be public facing and really kind of see what they're about. Obviously, one of the goals behind this show is to kind of see what management is all about. I feel like you do that really well. I mean, you're quite outspoken in terms of cannabis. You're very articulate in how you speak about pushing cannabis legalization forward. Was that something that you thought about deliberately? This is how I want to lead, or this sector deserves some kind of loud amplification? How, or is that just your personality? How did you kind of settle on that style or think about settling on a style?
Good question. I would say it's a little more evolution than a decision and a plan on paper. So it's what started small has grown, whether it's been publicly on TV, on podcasts like this, and social. Twitter has been, you know, there's a lot of action on Twitter, BCOV9. There's a lot of action on Instagram. We just started one, Ben Kovler, GTI, new territory. But people are interested. I sort of have said that the country is overwhelmed with canna curiosity. People want to understand this product. They've heard about it. Everybody wants to sleep better, or they have pain, or they have a relative with cancer, right? Or they don't like being hungover anymore, or they saw that image or the ad or something. So there's so much curiosity, and we can bring a voice of reason, of fact-based information that leads to good decision-making, which is really what we're all about. And that's sort of resonating, whether it's talking about cannabis tax dollars being greater than alcohol tax dollars for states, which is a really important thing, or demystifying what's going on in rhythm, eighth, or what the flower is about, or how we're going to bring jobs and big capital spend to a prison, or even being critical of politicians at times if people are slow or saying the wrong thing. You know, I'm not going to call anybody out, but a certain governor in the country recently said, if you legalize cannabis, you'll kill your kids. Like, that's a lie, and that needs to be called out.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that extreme all the time, but that's actually a governor of one of the actual 50 states. But we think that if we lead with facts and participate in a respectful, meaningful, you know, engagement, that's what American democracy is. We're a business for profit for our shareholders. That's our role here. But we think we can enable a ton of well-being for American consumers. Like, this is an amazing thing, and there's all that positivity going. So it sort of fuels some of the passion by which people are interested. There's more question marks floating over people's heads than actual opinions based on facts. People don't really know. They're interested. And, you know, what's going to happen when you can go to a place and consume cannabis and have the experience on site? How's that going to be? What's going to happen then? Because if you look at what we have today, we basically encourage people to drink, lose their judgment, and hopefully don't drive off a cliff on the way home. That's what we do. I just think there's a better way. There's a lot of other newness as we kind of open up ideas for it. And what's awesome about cannabis is we have a huge tidal wave behind us of demand. So that could be jobs. The social change here is real. The war on drugs locked up and hurt a lot of minorities. Full stop. It didn't work. So this industry is coming with a lot of momentum and positivity. Who are we going to employ? Who's going to get rich? How are we going to create new wealth? What's it going to look like in 5 or 7 years? It's not so much about today. It's about the setup for the future. If this is going to go from 20 billion to 80 billion, it's not going to be controlled by Green Thumb. It's going to be a lot of people winning. There's going to be a lot of people here. And, you know, we've noticed that we have a voice that people are interested in hearing what we have to say. And so we'll keep saying it respectfully, engaging in dialogue and kind of sticking up for what we believe that's pretty core for us.
Speaking about that social equity component and kind of trying to drive and right a lot of those wrongs, Illinois, you know, has kind of, at first their social equity plan was very celebrated and now it's been less celebrated in terms of how it's come to market. What are your thoughts, because you play so largely a part in the Illinois market, what are your thoughts on that state's social equity, kind of how they developed it?
Yeah, I think the law had a home run, an A-plus intent. Mm-hmm. I think the execution has been not the case at that level. However, you know, it's 710 days since Governor Pritzker signed the law, and there's still no social equity licenses owned by anybody, no minorities in the industry. So that's a miss. But, you know, we can't do much about the last 710 days. What we have to do is focus on today and then what the next 700 days are going to look like. And here's the deal. There's legislation that's made its way through the House and the Senate that will enable the lottery. There were some things clogged in the system. Now they're going to have a lottery. People are going to win. Hopefully a lot of those people are social equity minority candidates that have applied. There was noise in the scoring. Hopefully they've cleared a lot of that up. But the net is there'll be 185 new stores, and the maximum one group can win is 3. So therefore, there'll be at least 61, 62 new groups coming in. My guess is 100. And hopefully that's a lot of new people that can come into the industry where there's a ton of demand. It's about a $1.5 billion market today. We think it goes to $3 to $4 billion easy. And that's great. That's awesome. They need a lot of product. That's great for our shareholders. That's great for the new people that are going to get wealthy on this. That's great for the new entrepreneurs that have applied. We just got to get going. And so now the pressure shifts to sign the bill. When is the lottery? Give out the licenses. When can people open? That's really going to become the focus. We're excited to incubate new entrepreneurs. What that means is we're going to write a check to people that have won, that come. We're going to do a little like competition business pitch where people can win a loan from us. It'll be market rate for them to be successful. We know this industry really well. It'll be more than dollars. There'll be professional support services to enable success for new entrepreneurs. You know, we believe in this. We're trying to put our money where our mouth is. And try to execute this. But it's a public-private partnership and regulated. It's very complicated. But I think Illinois is going to do it. It's been slow. However, I think what will happen will be good, and I think other states can learn from Illinois. And so it's not about looking back or the blame. It's about how will New York, we hope on 1/1/23, what, 18 months from today-ish, 19 months, open a program, adult use, with others in the industry, not simply me and us and the current owners. And how do we enable opportunity broadly? You know, we're not afraid to talk about it. We're not afraid to have those ideas. So I think Illinois is on a good path right now. I think it'll look really good, hopefully, in a few months. Hopefully the lottery happens. That'll be the tell. And we're off to the races. And then I think the Ohios, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Maryland, you name it, can all learn from what's happened here in Illinois. And we're happy to be, you know, vocal and helpful with our role, which can enable opportunity.
I like it. I like it. Speaking of Illinois and the movement, and you also mentioned, you know, kind of wanting to put all your stuff out there, that if somebody reads a story about you, you know, you're proud of what they read. There was a Chicago Tribune story, I guess it was a couple of months ago, about Green Thumb. You guys have a statement, pretty immediate response to it. Do you have anything that you want to share about that, or anything you want to tell investors about that story, or kind of is that a notion of growing, being a big player and having a target on your back? Talk to us about what that is exactly.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's some of that. There's really no new news. We stand by the statement. We were surprised when the call came in that had non-facts associated with it. We don't think the Tribune did a good job. That's not a secret. And we're here. We're ready to engage.
The other thing that I wanted to talk about, especially vis-a-vis kind of the alcohol business and talking about how cannabis can do so much better in terms of recreation, certainly in terms of the medical aspect. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the beverage side of things and how you see that playing out. Sure. I know you guys are involved on that product side.
Yeah, we're bullish. America is comfortable consuming liquid in a social environment. Not a shock, right? Whether it's a coffee house, a tea house, or a bar. And we made a deal with Can. We think Can is a winning beverage in low dose cannabis beverages. The key is the low dose because it's a small amount. It's comfortable for other users to come in. And this is a play to take people away from an alcoholic beverage like a White Claw into a can. And so what we really think is as the world evolves, there'll be more on-site consumption on-prem. And we want to be positioned for that. For us, in our spot, it's a real advantage. We can trial it out. We can do a partnership, and we don't have to bet the house on it if you're a shareholder. But we have optionality. Talked about sort of optionality maximization. It's a perfect example where we can have optionality on beverage. We can understand it. We've got a great beverage line. We're learning a lot about it. It's great for Luke and Jake. We really support the brand and what they're about and the Pride campaign going on this month. I don't know if you have any images of it, but it's great. So it's a major win-win as we learn about what the consumer wants. It's not a rush. The supply chain is not ready for beverage. We don't see beverage blowing up to the upside anytime mm-hmm. very soon, but we're learning about it.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like... it gets adopted at some point as it gets figured out, like that it displaces or there's a room for kind of like a cannabis bar type of approach?
Displaces what?
I was going to say displaces like alcohol bars, but I'm not sure that it displaces it, but I feel like it could stand side by side with it.
Yeah. I mean, the same way hard seltzer is eaten away at a lot of whether it's right. beer or the alcohol, cannabis will eat at that. Right. Whether it's flower or beverage or not, beverage is going to grow a lot. Cannabis is going to grow a lot. A lot's going to have to do with what the experience is like. And what I mean by that is where and when and who, literally, how does it work? But we see a spot for beverage. We love the canned drink. We love the branding and what it's about and how it brings in a new user in a safe, controlled, trusted way. You're not going to overdose on one or two cans. So one is 2 milligrams of THC. You're not going to have too many. You're not going to have that problem of too many gummies. And so that's core to who the consumer is. Not likely to convert somebody who's smoking a lot of joints or dabbing or things like that. It may be a product available for them, but this is a new user, new entrant, comfort, bring them in.
I saw that you tweeted recently a picture of your dad that you brought him to a dispensary in Chicago. I'm curious what your family's reaction was when you said, I'm getting into cannabis.
Sure. Yeah, definitely brought my dad to Rise out in Lake of the Hills last weekend, Memorial Day weekend. Basically positive. Intrigue. My dad was surprised. I talked about the rhyme of history and how the family had done it before. And my mom was all aboard. So, I'm pretty open with my family. My wife was supportive. My kids are young and we're much younger. And now they're 10 and 8. And my daughter says to me, why don't you have a cool job? I'm very open. I just think you got to lead with the facts and what's going on. So the family's been supportive. It's often a question I ask in the interviews. It used to be much more a focal point. I think it's less of an issue these days. But, have you told your wife, husband, have right. you told your mom or your daughter, right. Whoever the person is, and what do they say? And sometimes they haven't told them yet. And that's usually you got to unpack that. Right. But I think the world has changed. I think it used to be like first mover and a little out there. And now it looks good. And people want to be associated with the industry. We have a huge amount of interest for jobs. And I think it's the right thing.
I agree. I'm curious. I saw somebody just wrote a book about talking to your kids about working in the cannabis industry. What do you tell your kids, or how do you talk to them about cannabis?
I haven't seen that book. I'm curious. They're
I'll
young.
Send you a link.
Great. It started as medicine, and we're growing a plant. Mm-hmm. And I've also warned them around, people that may be more negative without the facts, and you know, trying to lead with a little bit of patience on that. But they're young. I think the conversation will change.
Yeah.
Certainly an active conversation in our broad family, extended family. But you know, when cousins or relatives are, you know, the ages they are in college or high school, and they're sharing wine or beer at family occasions, I think in the next decade, family experiences may evolve.
Yeah.
Everybody will make their own decisions. No value judgment. But I just think being an open mind on the facts is usually a way to lead. And so I just think the experience will evolve, but not without its controversies. That's for sure.
Absolutely. Always a controversy.
But I'm excited, like at school functions, to be able to put together auction packages for our school and other schools in fundraisers now that it's legal. I'm excited to be able to give these and set up private function availabilities to make product available for people in a legal, safe environment. We have 70 and over focus groups working on CAN. We're able in outdoor events to have joints available. So we're really able to push the envelope in a very legal compliant way as we deal with a lot of these social questions that come up in family.
Very cool. Ben, as we wind down, what do you want to say to cannabis investors, or what do you feel like is worthy of how you kind of would advise them?
Oh, on cannabis investors?
Yeah.
Look, I mean, I'm aligned right there with you if you own Green Thumb. I'm long, you're long. I sleep really well at night, so that's all good. I think you got to have a little bit of patience. It's the same thing people say to me, or they did when I was learning about stocks. It's cannabis or otherwise. You know, it's a longer term game. You got to be comfortable with the management team you're investing in and understand the thesis. And so if you own Canadian LPs, understand why. If you own U.S. cannabis companies, understand why and what the upside is for that. I would also recommend keep it very simple and don't overtrade. Long-term ownership is the key to wealth generation. It's incredibly tax efficient and it's done wonders over the last, 100 plus years in America.
Some good advice. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I really appreciate you coming on. Is there anything that we left out? Anything you want to leave viewers, listeners with before we go?
I don't think so.
All right.
Try a lot more product. Get out there. Buy more.
Ben, it was a pleasure. Really appreciate you coming on. I hope this is the first of many conversations.
Yeah, it was fun. I like the questions. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Subscribe or follow us on Seeking Alpha, Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or Stitcher. And we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other investors find our show. If you have feedback or questions, we'd love to hear from you at RENA+CANPOD@SeekingAlpha.com. That's RENA+CANPOD@SeekingAlpha.com. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.